and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. That's a little bit of a more expanded translation, but communicates the effect of the verbs and the usages there. And he opened the bottomless pit, and the smoke went up out of the pit, like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Okay, we were down to about point 11 in this. While we literally, or generally, seek for the literal meaning, and that is, of course, the historical school of interpretation that we adhere to, is the literal grammatical method, that all languages, all documents, are to be understood first in their literal sense, and then, obviously, then you factor in, like, figures of speech, idioms, various forms like hyperbole or various other ways of communicating. But first, you have to understand the literal before you get to interpretation. So in this case, it is obvious that this must be intended figuratively, since the star is referred to by the masculine pronoun and is observed opening a lock with a key. 12, there is little doubt that a single angel is in view, one that is allowed some pretty great authority by God, as seen in the statement at the end of verse 1. Again, we have what Osborne has said throughout this, is what he calls the divine passive. That it said, certain verbs you'll find appear in the passive. It was said, it was given. Who did it? Well, ultimately, God did it. Whatever method he used in the meantime, or whether he directly did it himself, is really of little consequence. That this is the act of God, his hand, as it were, playing all this out. So 13, the angel is defined as coming from the heaven, which must be understood as the third heaven in this context, since we have concluded that this is not a literal star coming from space. And we certainly know there's no stars in the first heaven, the atmosphere. There are stars in stellar space, but we've concluded, you have to conclude here, this one I can be dogmatic on, that this is not a literal star, it's an angel. 14, the angel is described as having fallen to the earth by means of a perfect participle, which indicates that he had fallen in the past and was residing on the earth. That's the force of it. 15, the perfect participle here would indicate that John did not see this angel fall to the earth, but saw him after he had taken up this new position. He doesn't say, I saw a star falling from heaven. He could have said that. He said had fallen, which indicated that it was past. So Satan's confined, we're looking at a point here that must be beyond the midpoint by definition. Because Satan is not confined to earth, as we know, until the latter half. And so at the midpoint of Daniel's 70th week, there is Star Wars, literally, and the angels are cast out, the demons are cast out, rather. And they are now confined to the earth. And this is one of the things that it's interesting to note and to contemplate and to think about in terms of God and his plan. What happens when you humble yourself and you believe in Jesus Christ and you surrender your life to another? In effect, at the point of salvation, you give up the rights to your life. Now, that's what happens. And at that point, you are what we might say, if you take it to its literal, and Paul did, and other believers did too, you are a slave. And now a slave, by definition, has no freedom. A slave is a slave. He is what he is. And so as you start out in the plan of God, the irony of all of this is you start out as a slave by giving your life to Christ, and God, over the course of your existence into eternity, gives you greater and greater and greater freedom. And with those who maladjust and orient to God, he's seen doing the opposite. He's shutting them down more and more and more and more and more until at some point they'll all be confined in the lake of fire. They'll have no freedom whatsoever. They forfeit their freedom because they didn't know how to use it or didn't want to use it properly. And so that's one of the things I thought about as I was going through this. I thought, you know, for the believer, for the person who's positive, they get greater and greater and greater blessings and freedom in terms of God's plan. Those that are negative get confined more and more and more and more. And that's the root meaning of the word tribulation, in fact. The Greek term philipsis, that means that which is pressed together, that which is compact, and that which puts pressure on you. And so it's translated typically by the word tribulation in the New Testament. But God is seen one by one now. Satan is becoming more and more and more confined. His freedoms are one by one being taken away from him. And what God's doing is right. This is only fair and just and righteous. So, again here, having fallen indicates now he's stuck to the earth. Now he can't get off of this planet. See, his goal always was to rule this planet. Well, let's see you rule it, buddy. And we're going to get 3.5 years of pure Satan. Oh, well, I mean, not us, but the world will. Pure, concentrated evil. So the perfect participle again indicates that he didn't see him. He saw him after the new position. 16, in fact, Munz calls the perfect participle here a dramatic perfect and translates it as that had just fallen, which is actually a pretty good explanation of the timing of this event, which must occur during the latter half of Daniel's 70th week. 17, the verb pito, to fall, is used only 3 times in the perfect tense in the New Testament. And all 3 usages indicate that the fallen condition is something less than desirable. It's used in Acts 15:16. So this term, when you see the perfect of pito, it's telling you that it's a bad situation, just by the very usage of that word in that tense. Acts 15:16, after these things I will return, and I will rebuild the tabernacle of David which has fallen. There it's used in the perfect tense, that this is a bad situation. The tabernacle of David in this fallen state is viewed as far less than desirable. And I will rebuild its ruins, and I will restore it. And it's also used only one other time in Revelation 2:5. In those letters to the churches, specifically the church at Ephesus. See, the danger of becoming an Ephesian-type church is very real for doctrinal churches, because the Ephesian-type church had a lot going for it in terms of doctrine. As he tells them, I know your deeds, and that you cannot endure evil men, and you put people to the test who call themselves apostles. And they're not really apostles. They just call themselves apostles. They just assumed the mantle and said, hey, I'm an apostle. Hey, well, good for you. No, you're not. Idiot. You're not an apostle. And people are still running around today calling themselves apostles, believe it or not. And so you have the doctrinal grid to test these people. And this is the Ephesian church. They had a good, sound, strong doctrinal grid. And they checked things out. They didn't just buy everything at face value. And they looked into it and they said, no, this doesn't wash. This doesn't fit. This doesn't square with what I know to be correct. And so they are not, and you found them to be false. And indeed, they were false. And so this church had a lot on the ball doctrinally. And you have persevered and have endured for my name's sake and have not grown weary. This is a church that had a high level of divine good production. Now, this is a church who applied towards one another. And guess what? That's where your applications have to come. You've given a spiritual gift, as Peter says, as each one of you has received a particular gift, employ it in serving one another. It doesn't mean I've given you this gift, keep it for yourself. And this is, in effect, of course, the essence of Christianity. And you can sum Christianity up in one very easy word that communicates the whole of it all. And it's a fun word that people like. And so they say, give me some of this. Whoops, no, I don't want that. But this is what Christianity is all about. Biblical Christianity focuses on the giving of yourself, whether it's in your marriage, whether it's to your kids, whether it's to other believers. And the whole thing can be summed up in this word. And it's not about what you're going to get out of it. That's it. If that's your motive, what's in it for me? Well, you're never going to make it as a very solid believer. Because if you're not willing to pay the price, and make the sacrifices, well, that's the way life goes. But this sums it all up pretty well. And this church, this Ephesian church, had this together. But I have this against you, that you've left your first love. And as we pointed out, as the apostles faded from the scene and the miraculous things ceased at the beginning of the church age, and life sort of went into this sort of humdrum phase, that everything, every day wasn't exciting. All the apostles were dying off. And there's no such thing as apostolic succession, so there are no more apostles. When they die, that's it. There were 12 of them. Once they're dead, then they're gone. and that office ceased to exist. And so we say today there's no longer an office of apostle. And so as things were settling down into this sort of daily grind, it's very easy to get caught up in the daily grind and lose your focus on what's really important. It's very easy to get caught up looking at the temporal things and not keeping your eye on the prize. And that is a challenge for all of us. We all have to fight against that. It's easy to let the paralysis creep in. You do less and less and less in terms of production, in terms of helping other believers, in terms of anything. And then pretty soon, well, then it's then we just become a group of people who meet, we study the Bible, and we go home, we live our own little individual lives. That's not what a church is all about. And these people had settled into this sort of humdrum existence. And it's characterized as leaving your first... They're not excited about doctrine anymore. They've got a lot of doctrine, let's face it. I mean, that's implied by what he says to them. That you've got the doctrinal grid pretty well straight. The challenge is the motivation. What motivates me to continue to apply? Or to just say, well, you know, I don't need to study this week. Word of God, big deal. You know, if you want a pastor like that? I wouldn't want to be one. So remember, therefore, from where you have, there's our verb, fallen. Fallen from a higher position to a lower one. This church was in danger, of course. Change your mind and do the deeds you did at first. Remember how in early on in the Christian life, when everything was new, the doctrine was new, you were excited. You just, and you know how we were. You know, we just thought everybody would love this. Oh boy, were we wrong. We just thought, you know, when I got on doctrine, I thought, well, everybody's going to like this. And then people were, you know, they'd start separating from me, saying, you know, no, I'm not interested. One guy separated from me and told me, I know what you're saying is true, Ron, and I believe it, but I can't go that way because my wife wouldn't. Oh, love father or mother or husband or daughter or husband or wife more than me? You're not worthy of me. Not me, but the Lord. And so this guy was ever, I mean, he was one of my very, very, very best friends ever. And we thought a lot alike, and we were very good friends. And he told me, I'm sorry, we've got to go our separate ways. And that was a sad day for me to hear that and to live through it. And I've lived through it time and time and time again. And I just assumed everybody would want to know. And, you know, you have this zeal, and you're ready to apply, and all you think about is SG3, and, oh, here's an opportunity to apply. And now we look around, and, well, oh, an opportunity, what, apply? No, I got stuff to do. Well, okay. And this is where we have to focus, and we have to prioritize. Or we end up like this Ephesian church. I would rather be a Philadelphia church, frankly, at the rapture. Myself, that's my opinion. That's my position. That's what I would like. Because they are commended to the high heavens. And in fact, promised that pre-tribulation, that pre-Daniel 70th week deliverance. So here the Ephesian church had fallen. They've left their first love. As I saw when we did this, this is the challenge. Do the deeds you did at first. Get back to the types of applications you were making in the beginning. And people get worn down and they get tired. And this is where you have to focus on what's important. If you're going to compartmentalize your life, I got this life part and this part of my life, this part of my life, and this part of my life, and the doctrine doesn't affect all of it, you're making a huge mistake. So these three usages here are where pipto is used in the this perfect tense, and it is certainly a bad state, we might say. So the fact that this star has fallen in and of itself tells you that this is bad for him anyway. As it turns out, it's bad for everybody. 18, while most readily acknowledge that this is an angel, they are quite divided on the exact identification and whether or not this is an elect angel or a fallen angel. I don't think it's hard to tell that it's a fallen angel myself, personally, from the verb pipto, having fallen. A, some like Kittle, Walvoord, and Sweet believe this to be a demon. B, some identify it as Satan himself, based on the fact that this fits the imagery of Revelation 12, 7 through 9, which indicates that he was cast to the earth in the middle of Daniel's 70th week. And Revelation 7, or 12 rather, I'm sorry, 7 through 9, And there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon and his angels waged war. And they were not strong enough. And there was no longer a place found for them in heaven, and the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. So, and then 12:14, and the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness, where she was nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. And so we see him now actively, aggressively persecuting Israel in a ways that he has not even up to this point. Well, see, they further suggest that this builds on the imagery of Isaiah 14, 12 through 14, which describes Lucifer, and that was his pre-fall name, son of the dawn, as the morning star that had fallen to the earth. Beale, a noted commentator on this book, feels strongly that this is an evil angel sent from God, and argues that in the Old Testament and Jewish writings, a falling star always refers to a fallen angel. Others point out that this would be the only place in the book where God used an evil angel to execute his will, and question the fact that a fallen angel would be given the key to his own prison. Well, the fact that he's got a key and opens the door tells you he's not in the prison. That one, see, to me falls a little flat, because I'm like, he wasn't given the key to his prison. He's free. He's outside the door and opening it up. So he's not in prison. So that one falls a little flat, I think, because, again, that doesn't answer the question to me. And several note, for instance, Charles Ladd and Morris, that there appears to be little difference between the act of falling and descending, and suggest that this is the same angel that descends in Revelation 21. But, however, as we will point out, one, those are different verbs. There is some difference between falling and descending. Descending implies a willingness. Falling implies you've lost control. I saw an angel coming down from heaven. That's the word there. Coming down is a different verb than falling, though. And having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And so some identify this angel as that angel. Well, 19, the ones that assume, that suggest a fallen angel would not be given the key to his own prison, have merely assumed, and we know what happens when we assume, that this angel was imprisoned in the first place, a fact that is not suggested and not supported by the text. That's just assumption. And so this is one of the things you have to very much watch out for in terms of interpretation. Am I making an assumption here? Or does the text say this? And the text doesn't say that he was in prison. So they've read into that, and that's what we call eisegesis. Exegesis is reading out what the text says. Eisegesis is reading your assumptions and opinions into the text. 20, based on this reality, those that identify this as a fallen angel are correct. In fact, this is Satan, whose very history may be summarized by the term fallen. His first fall from perfection came at the moment he demonstrated negative volition and manufactured the first sin of pride. Ezekiel 28, 12, and 15. And it is more than ironic, it is an object lesson to every member of the human race on the danger of arrogance. And this is one of the real problems, again, of spiritual adolescence, is that it's very easy to become arrogant. And so this is the most dangerous sin, in my opinion, in the universe. It was the sin that Satan succumbed to. And this guy was a genius. It wasn't as though this was just some idiot floating around up there that had nothing better to do. This guy was a genius, a very much a genius. But now he's been corrupted. His genius has been corrupted. He's like, you know, the mad scientist now. Ezekiel 28:12, Son of man, take a lamentation over the king of Tyre here. You have two distinct passages here, the leader of Tyre and then the king of Tyre, who's the unseen spiritual agent behind the earthly leader. 28 verses 1 through 10 deal with the human leader of Tyre, where 28, 11 and following goes beyond that and looks at what's going on spiritually behind the scene. Thus says the Lord God, you have the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. you were in Eden, the garden of God. Now, see, you can't read that and interpret that verse as being the earthly king of Tyre. Eden has long since ceased to exist. So this has to go beyond. This is where the text forces you to say, well, okay, he can't be talking about the earthly king. Who is he talking about? Well, he's talking about Satan, Lucifer. So 28:12, and then also 15, you were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. And what was that unrighteousness? It was I will. It was exaltation of self-will over God's will. That is, in a short, the simplest definition of sin. I will. It's going to be my way. And then my will supersedes God's will. That is arrogance of the worst kind. And that will get you into all kinds of trouble. You have to always, no matter how you feel, no matter what you're going through, you have to discipline yourself to say, well, Father, not my will, your will. Jesus demonstrated what you have to do if you're going to be spiritually successful. And he demonstrated it, of course, in much more pressure and testing than we ever have. But that's the simple definition of sin. It's exalting your will over God's. And you know God's will. You've read the Bible. You understand some things. And you say, what's God's will in this matter? Well, I don't care what God's will is. I want my way. Okay. Go for it. You might fly. Then again, you might not. Then again, God may lower the boom on you. And I don't want to see that happen to you. So you have to preface everything with, okay, God, here's what I want, but ultimately, I'm going to humble myself, and I'm going to say, what do you want? And that's the definition, a short definition of humility. And that is the great believer that does that. Not the one that crashes through life getting his own way all the time. It's going to be my way or the highway. You know, well, that's okay, but that's not Christianity. That's not biblical Christianity. B, his second fall consisted of his demotion from the throne room of God when he was cast forth as being profane. Ezekiel 28:16b. Therefore I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God. I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. The heart lifted up is a figure for pride or arrogance. The exalted heart. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. So his first fall was his fall from perfection. He became imperfect. His second fall was his demotion out of his place in the throne room. See, his third fall will come at the middle of Daniel's 70th week, when he will be denied further access to the third heaven and confined to planet Earth. That is seen in our verse 9:1, and then in the verses we read in Revelation there, where he is confined to the earth. D, his fourth fall will come at the beginning of the millennium. See, he keeps getting lower and lower and lower. He was perfect. He's imperfect. He was the covering cherub in the throne room. Now he's cast down from that. You've lost your job, as it were. And then he's cast down to the earth and confined to that. Now he's going to go lower still. God's not finished humbling this guy yet. In fact, he'll never be finished with him. His fourth fall will come at the beginning of the millennium, when he will be bound and cast into the abyss for 1,000 years. Revelation 21:3. Can you imagine? Well, picture yourself alone 1,000 years in darkness to consider the error of your ways. And does Satan ever come to any decision that he's wrong? No. Nope, no matter how long God gives him to think about it, he'll never change his mind. And that's the negative volition. That's the evil, that he will not change his mind no matter what. And so this justifies and obviously explains why God did not offer salvation to angels. They wouldn't have changed their minds. It wouldn't have mattered. This is why he didn't become a God angel. But with mankind, men change their minds. Men repent of their nonsense and believe on Christ. So as fourth fall comes there, I saw an angel coming down from heaven having the key of the abyss and a great chain. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. You talk about, have you ever been in a straitjacket? Well, some of you should have been. But maybe you haven't yet. Thank God for Prozac, I guess. But can you imagine the frustration of this? You can't move for 1,000 years. How long is a second when you're there? How long is a week? How long is a month? I mean, when you start thinking about the frightening things that God's going to do, and that's why we tell people, the great and mighty day of the Lord, it's great for those who are oriented, or the great and awesome day of the Lord, but the great and terrible day of the Lord, it's terrible for those that aren't. And so Satan is going to endure this. I don't even want to think. It's hard to contemplate this in your mind. That God binds you and you can't move. I mean, in effect, a straitjacket. And see, he doesn't have to worry about eating and drinking and feeding him and all that because he's going to live anyway. You think he's going to be any better for all this? You think this will help him see how long he is? No, not at all. So his final fall will come at the end of the millennium, following the Gog and Magog rebellion, when he will be permanently confined to the lake of fire. Revelation chapter 20, verse 10. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. Now they've been there for 1,000 years. So for those that want to argue for annihilation, this verse destroys that doctrine. By annihilation, some people suggest that God's going to repent of all this at some point, and he will just take these people out of existence and remove their life. And he won't just torment them forever, but he will. And people can't handle that principle or that idea. And so they have to figure out a way to explain it away. But here you've got the beast and the false prophet who've been there for 1,000 years, and they're still there in the lake of fire. And they will be tormented by day and by night forever and ever. See, those are genitives of time. That just means they'll be tormented during the day and during the night. But the forever and ever makes this endless. Now, when we saw those genitives of time earlier in Revelation, and you have them here, but you don't just have it. Now, if it had stopped without forever and ever, you could make the case that they won't be tormented all the time. But because it says forever and ever, you can't make that case any longer. That destroys the genitive of time, in effect. Because as we pointed out, like, by day and by night means, it doesn't mean you're working 24 hours. Paul said, we work night and day with our hands. He doesn't mean we work 24 hours around the clock. He meant we work in the daytime and we work in the nighttime in order not to be a burden to any of you. And so, as he told the Thessalonians there, but here you could make a case for that, but with the forever and ever, nope, that destroys that. They're going to be tormented in the daytime and in the nighttime, and it's going to go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And that's his final fall, and F, he will spend eternity in that prison, being the most despised and abased creature there, Isaiah 14, 9-11. As we pointed out, the fallacious idea that Satan rules in hell is exactly that, a fallacious idea. He is going to be the most debased of all creatures. He is going to have the lowest part of hell for himself. As high as his exaltation was in the beginning, he's going to go to the opposite extreme because of negative volition. And he brings it all on himself, go figure. Why would anybody do this? Isaiah 14, 9, Sheol from beneath is excited to meet you when you come. I mean, here you got all these dead, negative unbelievers and all these fallen angels, and they're all trapped there. And here comes the one that got us here. Oh, we got a party for you. We hate your guts. It arouses for you the spirit of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They will respond and say to you, oh, even you have been made weak as we. Here you are, O mighty Satan. You have become like us. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. See, there's some indication that music, this was part of Satan's function, was to lead in the worship of God, and so therefore he was fitted for the whole concept of music. That he was the original source that God created for music, which tells you two things. One, God likes music. He doesn't like rap. Rap is not music. So, but you know, of course, you know, my dad, when I was, you know, he's listening to my music, he said, that's not music. You know, Jimi Hendrix was not for the previous generation, trust me. And Snoop Dogg ain't for me. He's a pig, frankly. He's a disgusting human being. And these are the role models that kids are supposed to look to. Oh, and Brittany, we saw her yesterday. I mean, she's quite, you know, something. Not a role model, but something, all right. So, again, here's Satan. Your music now is brought down to Sheol. I wonder what kind of music they'll be listening to. God, it'll be horrible. Can you imagine Satan trying to make music? Let's lift your spirits. No. And the amazing thing is music is designed to do that. It's designed to elevate. It's designed to lift. Now, see, rap is designed to debase. It is evident in its satanic origins. I'm not against all rap, per se, but the point is you look at the music and the content of it. There's nothing spiritual there. It's all just basically disgusting stuff in every way. Misogynists, basically despising women and using them for whatever they want. They believe the end justifies the means. Crime is more than inevitable. It's what we choose. And so their music reflects their lifestyle. So you've been brought down. If you ever saw that movie, The Shawshank Redemption, there was a scene in there where he gets into the office and he plays this music. And it's not music those guys would listen to. It was opera. But they all heard it, and for a moment, their spirits were lifted. And it had a profound impact on them. Well, there won't be any music in hell to speak of, and what it is, you wouldn't want to hear. I don't think there'll be any. Nobody's got anything to sing about. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you. Oh, I like that analogy. Are they literal maggots? I don't care. If they're not literal, what's he trying to portray? I don't even want to think about it if it's worse than literal maggots. That's one of the things that people look at this and they want to spiritualize it away. Okay, what are maggots spiritual for? We know they come out of death. We know what maggots are. I think everybody's seen a maggot. And I don't think anybody likes them. Anybody here like maggots? No? And worms are your covering. You talk about fear factor. And 15 through 17, nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? Yep, this is him. And look at this. Here you are now. Because of your actions, because of your choices. Well, 21, while he currently has access to the third heaven for the purpose of accusing and harassing believers, Job 1, 6 and 12, let's look at that, his permanent demotion to planet Earth results in a display of incredible anger. So what is Satan doing now? Well, now he's got his little plan and he's, you know, executing it. And his plan is to, of course, make God look bad. And he hates believers. There's no question about that. Job 1, 6 through 12. Now, there was a day when the sons of God, that's a technical for angels, came to present themselves before the Lord. The sons of Elohim, as we pointed out, have to be interpreted as angels because of Genesis 6 and other factors. And Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, where do you come from? Oh, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. I was just, you know, out checking things out. I ain't been doing nothing. Yeah, right. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Now, Satan ought to be asking himself if he had any smarts at all. He'd be like, why is he doing this? Why is God pointing me to Job? And why is God getting me all started? Now I'm thinking about Job. I can't get him out of my head. Well, sir, Job, I don't like him. He's like a bad Regis Philbin. And so Satan suddenly, now he's got Job in his mind. And he doesn't know why, of course, other than that God asked him. And he's like, oh, you like Job, huh? All right, where should I attack next? I'm a genius. Wile E. Coyote, super genius. Job. That's an idea. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant? Not till now. For there is no one like him on the earth. Oh, he's a goody-goody, huh? A blameless and upright man. Doesn't say sinless, said blameless. Said you couldn't really lay a legitimate charge against him. He sinned. He had his areas of weakness. But overall, when you considered his life and his lifestyle, you had to say this was a good guy. And an upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has? You protect him. Of course he fears you. And you have blessed the work of his hands, you evil so-and-so. I mean, that's Satan's view of God, of course. See, everything's turned around backwards for him. See, he sees light and he thinks it's darkness. He sees darkness and he thinks it's light. He lives in a world you and I can't even fantasize about because he's so evil. He never sees anything correctly. He's always corrupted in his wisdom. And so here's this mad genius running around, and now he's all off on Job. So he's going to go off on him, trust me. And now put forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, look, he's got, all he has is in your power. Don't put your hand on him. You can't harm him physically, but do anything you want to him. Now Satan, he should be saying, what's his plan here? Satan doesn't care. He's like, okay, this is right up my alley. I'm good at evil, and I'll go do evil on this guy. So it appeared it happened on the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in his oldest brother's house. A message came from Job and said to Job, and said the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them. Everything was all right. Then the Sabaeans attacked them. Well, who do you think stirred up the Sabaeans to do this? It was obviously satanic influence, and he stirred up these people, and they went and did it. They probably had nothing against Job up to that point either. And then they got to thinking, that Job, he's rich. He's got more than we have. So let's go kill a bunch of it. And they slew your servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven. Oh, can Satan have fire come down out of heaven? Apparently. And burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. You talk about a roast. Here you go. I alone have escaped to tell you. So Job, you know, he couldn't look on the bright side. I said, well, at least got two servants left. But while he was still speaking, another one came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. I don't know if these three were lucky or if they were all just chickens. You know, but they survived all this somehow. See, now this is where some interpreters are going to see they were all cowards. The text doesn't say that. It just says they got away. While he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in your oldest brother's house. They were having a big party. They were just there together having fun. They weren't bothering anybody. And behold, a great wind came from the wilderness. Oh, can Satan control the weather at some point? Yes, he can. See, we recognize that even that, though, is in God's hand. He gives him the power to control the weather, apparently, from time to time. And do you think if Satan has the power to control the weather, that he's going to use it for good? I don't think so. And so we say, well, all weather is from God. No, it's not. See, that's an overgeneralization. It doesn't address what the text says. The text clearly implies here that Satan did this. And he did all this by himself. He didn't need any help. He could stir up the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans. He can bring fire down out of heaven. He can create great winds. His power is growing. So the house fell on him and killed all your kids, all the young people, and they died. I alone have escaped the tide. How'd you like to be the guy to deliver this message? And Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and we know he handled it. He cycled doctrine on this situation. He didn't freak out. He didn't let his emotions control him. He cycled doctrine, and he said, you know what? God has got my life in his hand. He knows what he's doing. I didn't bring anything into this world, as Paul tells Timothy, and it's a darn sure sight you're not taking anything out. So the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, could you apply doctrine at that level under this test? Our tests aren't even that big, and we can't bring the doctrine to bear on them. So, through all this, he did not sin or blame God. And we see the same thing. I don't want to read all this and get it's a fascinating study, though, of the dynamic between God and Satan, of the dynamic between Satan and Job, and then ultimately how Job handles it. And we should know, I mean, while we haven't studied the book, you know that Job maintained his integrity. And he handled all this, and then finally, he cracks. Well, we've cracked under a lot less than this. So it's pretty hard to be too down on Job, of course. So again, Satan says, now you touch his body, basically. So Satan apparently can control disease at some point, too. And everybody says, all disease is from, you know, God controls whether you live or die. Yes, he does. Satan can't do anything about killing you. But he could make you very sick if God gives him the freedom to. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, verse 7, and smote Job with sore boils. If you've ever had one boil, you know what it's like. And this guy had boils everywhere on his body. From the sole of his head, you know how tender your scalp can be? Try getting a bunch of boils up there. And certain parts of your body are more tender than others. You know, you might get a boil on your hand, and it might not feel quite so bad. Your hands might be calloused and tough, and so you can handle that thing. You get a boil under your armpit, that's a different deal. That's a little more tender under there. So, and he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Here he's been reduced to this. And it's still, he does not blame God for any of this. And of course his friends come to help him, and that's what cracks him finally. His friends help him. Oh God, help me. Deliver me from my friends. So, obviously he cracks really before they begin to talk, but he just can't take any more. The pain and the suffering are so intense. And so here again, now he is out here harassing believers at this point. Revelation 12:10 points out that one of his functions is to accuse believers. This is activity we really ought to watch in our lives. This deal of accusing people. And how often do we accuse people and we've just assumed? We've just made an assumption. We've made a judgment about their mental attitude or this or that or the other. Why is it that as human beings, we generally tend to impute the worst to people? And we assume all people are idiots. Well, a bunch of them are. We know that. But that's not the mentality we need to live with. So here, the accuser of our brethren, as he's called him, has been thrown down, who accuses them before our God day and night. So when you're ready to accuse, recognize, you know, what spirit you're from, we might say. And so, again, in any organization, whether it's a church or a football team or any organization, if the players aren't on the same page, you're not going to win. You know, and you've seen this happen. I've seen it happen. You know, they'll be in the middle of a big football game and something will happen and two players will go berserk, or a player will start screaming at the coach. That's always a good way to win. I wouldn't recommend it. And they'll just go ballistic on each other. Well, it's clear the team's now divided. And you're not going to win a football game with a divided team. It's a team effort. And the same thing's true in a church or any organization, any human organization. You can't have this division and this rancor that exists and be successful. And so this is why, of course, we are exhorted to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace and to be peacemakers. So here's Satan again. He gets cast down, and now he can't accuse us anymore in heaven. Not us, but any believer. In verse 12, for this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And he knows exactly how short it is. He's read the prophecies. So 22, this event takes place just following his ejection from heaven and confinement to the earth, at which time he is given the key of the bottomless pit, which is literally the shaft of the abyss. 23, the first term, freer, shaft, refers to a narrow, deep hole in the earth and is used of wells. I mean, we know what a water well is. You would dig down and quite some distance usually to get below the bedrock and get to the water. There are shallow water wells, obviously, but for drinking water, you want a deep water well. And the second term, abuthos, Now that's, for instance, there in John 4, where the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, literally means a bottomless pit, an abyss, and denotes the whole structure of Hades and Sheol. Alright, well, our time is up, so we're going to just stop there today, and we will deal with this and continue plowing through here on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.